On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Sadly, I have to announce the passing.
Whatever.
Good afternoon, good evening, good night, good after morning, good night. The Ron Van Dam Show. What's going on with you? Hey, what is with you, huh? What are you doing? What are you trying to get away with there? Hey, put that back. Hey, put that down. Hey, get off my lawn. Seriously, get off my lawn. I'm not kidding you. I take that very personally, lawn things. I've got a thing about lawn signs. Get them off my lawn. Take them off of your lawn. I don't like it. When I drive down the street, I want to see pretty stuff. I don't want to see signs on your lawn, or I don't want to see your grass uncut. They should take your house away from you. If you can't get your front yard looking good, and I mean looking nice to the point where when I drive down the street, I can enjoy myself and tour and cruise in my car and just have my surroundings beautiful. If you can't do that, if you got garbage in your front yard or a car up on blocks, or a dead person in the front yard, or anything like that, you should have your house taken away. I think they should do that at the mortgage closing. They could say, okay, house is $250,000. The check, okay, and then you have to sign this waiver that if you don't keep the front of your house and your front yard looking good, then we have the ability to start fining you and take your house away from you. Do you agree to that? Oh, okay. Or no, I can't do that. This is America. You can't force me to do that. Okay, then you don't get the house. Oh, crap. Okay, I'll do it. I think that should be. I think America is the beautiful. I think it should stay beautiful. And I think the garbage is disgusting. I really do. And if you buy a house on a main street, then good luck to you, because you should be fined. If there's any garbage on your curb, that's your responsibility. It's your job. If you can't get it together, then the house should be taken away from you. Once again, I think all these towns and cities are crying, oh, I can't have enough money to do snow plowing. I don't have enough money for infrastructure. We can't repair the roads. We can't take care of our own people. Oh, just start seizing houses, man. Start seizing property. That's all. These people will stop it. Well, Ron, what if they don't have enough money to clean up their front yard? Like, is that my problem? No. They come up with a payment plan. I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea. When I bought my house, Ron, I had a viable job. Now I don't have a viable job. And they want to take my house away because there's garbage in the front. Hey, here's what you do, babe. Put some pants on. Go outside. Put a nail on a stick and pick up the garbage. How about that? It doesn't cost a lot of money to make the front of your house or the front of your abode look nice. That's all. I'm not asking to plant shrubs. I'm not asking for a Japanese goldfish pond. I'm not asking for that stuff. All I'm looking for you to do is pick up the garbage and mow the lawn, man. Mow the lawn. But Ron, I can't afford a lawnmower. Then you can't afford the house. Get out of the house, sell the house. If you can't afford a lawnmower, then get out of the house, sell the house. You shouldn't have the house. That's what I'm saying. I don't think anybody's going to argue with me except for everybody who's listening to this show, because that's the way I feel. I was very chagrined yesterday. Oh, I had chagrins all over my face. Chagrined. I was driving in my car, which I love to do. Do you like to drive in your car? Do you like to drive in my car? You're not going to drive my car. Drive your own car. I'm driving in my car, and in front of me was a car, which I don't like to begin with. There should be never a car in front of me, ever. And I think there were some teenage kids in there, man, because teenage kids, unruly, they are wild. They are, oh, they are the death of civilization, these teenage kids. Mm-mm-mm. I think childhood should stop at 8 and pick up again around 27. And I think everything in between, not necessary. Anyway, so this car's in front of me and there's some kids in it, man. And all of a sudden, out of the side passenger window, which is the only one that opens, by the way, the windshield passenger window and the rear windshield passenger windows do not open, apparently, but the side ones do. This guy's arm comes out of the car with a cup in it, probably one of those McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's cups. I'll blame all of you, 7-Eleven cup, whatever. And it had like a straw in it, I think. I couldn't see. It was a little far away. And guy tosses the cup out, and it lands on the ground, and this guy keeps going. Now, I had a couple of options here. I could start doing the road rage crap where you start tailing the guy really close, get his license plate, call the police department, that kind of thing. I have a feeling that if I call the police department and gave him the license plate number, I believe, and I'm not sure that this is true, this is all speculation on my part, but I try to think things through before I do them now, because that's the difference between an adult and a teenager. When you're a teenager, you just do them. When you're an adult, before you do them, you think them through. You think like, okay, all right, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. That's what an adult's supposed to do. So I'm thinking, okay, if I call the police station and say I'm on the rear end of a car that just threw a soda cup out the window onto the street, the police would probably respond. And I don't know if it's the case. I guess it depends on the police department, what town you're in. But they probably respond by saying, what the hell do you want us to do about it? I think they would say that because there's no proof. The cop is like, you know, a half a mile behind me by the time I make the phone call. They can always say, well, we didn't throw a cup out the window. This guy's crazy. I mean, you know, it just kind of doesn't happen. And I'm realizing that unless there's a cop that sees you throw a cup out the window, you're probably going to get away with throwing the cup out the window. Now, there's going to be crazy people that are going to tail you if you're the one doing it, and you might have some trouble in that sense. But it's one of those crimes that I just don't think you can really do anything about. I don't think they're going to put you in a lineup at the police station and have a bunch of people, is this the guy that threw the cup out? I don't know. I wasn't there. I mean, you know, does this look like the kind of guy that would throw a cup out a window? I don't know. I don't know what they look like. I guess they're cupless, but I don't know. Could you put a cup in his hand and I'll see if I can recognize the hand in the cup? I can't tell. How do you prosecute that kind of thing? But when I see it, I get mad for two reasons. One is because they're doing it to begin with. And second is I don't think there's much I can do about it even if I see it. There's really not much. Take a picture. Take a picture after it happens. Why would I take a picture of a car in front of me just in case a hand comes out with a cup in it? I mean, you don't do that. You can't do it. It's not feasible. The only other thing to do is have a running video camera on my dashboard 24/7. And you know what? I'm just not that crazy. Come close, but not that much. But when I see somebody throw garbage out the window, I'm defense. I don't know what to do. I can't do anything about it. I can't do anything about it. All I can do is go, oh my God, look what I just saw. Isn't that horrible? Isn't that a horrible thing that just happened with the car and the car window? And that's about it. When I was growing up, there was a commercial. I think you remember this if you're old enough. This might be a generation test here. There was a commercial, and it was in black and white. So, yeah, I'm that old sometimes. Other times I'm not. Or maybe I saw it after the fact, and it was like a retro commercial. I don't know. There's an Indian on the side of the road, and someone throws a cup out of a moving car. And they have a close-up of the Indian's face who's standing on the side of the road, and a tear comes down his cheek from his eye, and it's very sad. The poor Indian who basically built this country, is that the inference here? The Indian went to all the trouble of, like, get in the country together and look what these jerks are doing from this generation, throwing... Well, here's the funny thing about the commercial, if you look a little bit deeper. First of all, they wouldn't do that anymore because Indians don't stand on the side of the road really at all. I mean, they're pretty much, they've got reservations. They're not standing. How often do you drive down the street and say, oh, there's another Indian standing on the side of the road? I don't know why they're doing this, but they just seem to stand there. They don't stand on the side of roads, A. B, Indians don't dress in full headdress gear and war paint on their skin. This Indian was wearing a leather skirt and a full headdress like you see standing outside of a cigar store. And they just don't do that anymore. Kind of haven't done it for a whole lot of years. And if you were driving down a highway and you saw an Indian with a headdress standing there and no shirt and a leather skirt, or whatever you call that thing, you'd probably say to yourself, I'm not throwing this out the window. I'm going to, I don't know, but this is more interesting than the garbage. And then the other thing is pretty much that here's an Indian, probably from the early 1800s, standing on the side of a road watching a car go by. And is he crying because someone threw a cup out the window or because he misses the horses? You know, and not only that, but we're so politically correct now that you just don't have Indians standing on the side of the road. It's not right to do. And by the way, if someone said, I saw an Indian standing on the side of the road, you probably say, where was he from? New Delhi? Because we don't think of the American Indians anymore. We did a horrible thing to them. I think that our fellow man that came over to this country, I wasn't here. I don't know if they walked up to the Indians and said, excuse me, but I'd like to coexist with you. And the Indians said, no way, get out of here. I have no idea what happened. Get off my lawn, I think they said. I don't think they said, all right, you can settle here if we can build casinos. I don't think they did that either. I don't know what happened exactly, to be honest with you. I was horrible in history class. I didn't listen to a thing that the history teachers said because it's over. It's done. I have the mind that says, what do I care about what happened before? I only care what's happening now, what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't care about what happened before. That was probably all messed up. I don't know. Did I have anything to do with it? No? Then why are you bothering me with that information? Why do you think I care about what people did in the 1800s? It has a lot to do with where we are now in history, perhaps. But at the same time, I can't care, man. I've only got one mind. Why are you feeding me all this information about stuff that already happened, man? Give me some information that can move me forward, that can make me think and be progressive and create and invent and move forward. Don't give me information that stuff that happened 400 years ago. I don't know if I care because I don't know. I don't care. I guess I don't care. Hello, my name is Ron Van Dam.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today? What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today?
Okay, what are you wearing today? I don't care.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today? What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today?
How you doing? At the time of this podcast, spring is upon me. This is actually spring. Temperature outside is about 25 degrees, very spring-like. The little bunnies are freezing their little asses off, bunny asses. Easter is just a little more than a week away. I remember went to the Easter parade in New York decades ago, and it was like 100 degrees outside, and I'm thinking, that ain't gonna happen. That ain't gonna happen here. That ain't gonna happen. That would be global warming. 100 degrees on Easter? That'd be global warming. I'd say, oh my God, uh-oh. Yeah, times have changed. I mean, I'm you know, I'm no better than you are. Well, that's not true. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. This has happened to me in my 20s. Actually, I wasn't even 20 yet. I think I was like 18 years old. Actually, it was my first job, my first real job. I was living in New York City. This is a funny story.
Okay, get comfortable, everybody. It's time for one of Ron's funny stories.
I was living in New York City, and I was going to college. I was going to New York University down there in Greenwich Village. My first job, I had gotten through my father's new wife. My parents were divorced when I was 13. They say it wasn't my fault, but there were pictures of me on the wall with dart holes in them, so I don't know. So here's what happened. So, I'm looking for my first job, and I'm going to New York University, and my father pretty much is saying to himself, you know, son, you should go out and you should work instead of living off of me. And I said, okay, you cheap bastard, sure. Although he was paying for college, so I guess I shouldn't call him a cheap bastard. Although he's passed away, I guess I can call him that because he's not going to hear me. Unless you believe in the afterlife, and I'm not too keen on that concept just yet. Maybe later, not just now. So anyway, so so my husband's new wife, her name was Joan. And she says to me, you know, I can get you a job if you want one. And of course, I felt like saying, I don't want one. But I of course, was obligated to say, thank you so much. Her best friend was this lady, her last name was Rugoff. And back then, there was a major chain of movie theaters in New York City called Rugoff Theaters. And they've since gone out of business. Everything I touch basically eventually goes out of business. So it's just so true. It's not funny. I mean, everything goes out of business eventually, so I guess that's not right. And then it's not my fault. Anyway, so I said, okay. And she says, yeah, would you like to be a movie theater usher? I thought, oh, man, okay. Sounds like fun, man. Movie theaters, you get to see the movies, get to meet all the chicks. The chicks are free. Yeah, sounds good, Joan. And she sets it up, so I don't even have to get an interview. I am going to be a movie theater usher. Now, let me tell you something. Being a movie theater usher, and if you are one or you know one, then excuse me for saying this, but it's one of the few jobs in the world where if you're breathing and you can stand up, you've probably got the job. It's not a brain trust kind of thing. There's no SAT scores involved. They don't check your college credentials. They don't really give a shit about anything. They would prefer that you're stupid enough not to accept the paychecks, but apparently that's not the case. So I said, yeah, fine. So I report for work, and I go to the Beekman Theater, which, again, the Beekman Theater does not exist anymore. It's been torn down. Now it's an apartment house in New York City. It was on 2nd Avenue and 66th Street, and a beautiful neighborhood on the east side of Manhattan, and a beautiful ritzy theater. The seats in the theater were velvet, man, velvet seats. Yes, very ritzy thing. It had these draped curtains that actually opened up, and then the movie screen was there. It was a very opulent theater. And they actually served demi-tasse coffee in the lounge while you were waiting for the previous film audience to leave. You sat in the lounge area and they gave you coffee. I think you had to pay for it, but it was available. But in little tiny demi-tasse cups. And we as a staff in the theater had to continually make this coffee for the customers. The theater sat about probably about 600 people. It's a good-sized theater. The Beekman Theater. So there we are. And what's showing there at the time is Diary of a Mad Housewife with Richard Benjamin and Kerry Snodgrass. I remember it. And the movie theater manager, his name was Robert Edwards, and he had a crew cut, and he was gay. And this was before gay had a word connected to it. They were called homos or homosexuals. Gay was not even part of the language yet, I don't believe. But he was. And you didn't discuss it. You didn't look at it. You didn't think about it. It's just something that it was not accepted in those days, especially for a guy. So anyway, that's just a little social background. So it's my first day, and I had to wear a uniform. I had to wear a tuxedo. Now, it wasn't just a regular tuxedo. It was what I call a monkey tuxedo, the kind that organ grinders wear. You wear a bow tie, and you wear pants with a velvet stripe down the outside of the leg, tuxedo pants, and that's still done. But the tuxedo jacket was not the full-length jacket. It was a monkey jacket. It was, I don't even know what you call the things, but it was kind of short on the sides and then a long tail on the back. It was embarrassingly stupid looking, but we all wore one. There were about six ushers on duty at any given time in this theater. It was the kind of theater that it was, by the way, in those days, a movie theater, one screen, one theater, that's it. It was exciting in those days because we would premiere movies in New York that would just open at that theater, and that was it for the whole country. So, yeah, they did the red carpet stuff with the searchlights, and the directors would show up and the cast. It was a very exciting time in New York as far as movies were concerned. Movies were the big thing. So I'm wearing my monkey uniform and stuff, and I become talkative to one of the other movie theater ushers. And it's New York. It's my first job. And I learned that there were people who lived in New York who weren't necessarily Caucasian Jews. And I was floored by this concept. I thought everybody was. No, Ron, there are many different nationalities that have jobs in New York City. Again, I'm a young kid. I mean, I was 18 years old, maybe 17, 18, something like that. So anyway, is another kid. He's about, he's about 17, 18 years old as well. And his name was Jesus. And I called him Jesus, and obviously he wasn't a Caucasian Jew. He was Jesus, Hispanic, of course. And one day I saw him write his name out on some kind of application or some kind of sign something, and he signed it Jesus. And I thought, well, that's a little egotistical, isn't it? You sign everything Jesus, like you're like the son of the Lord or something. He says, hey man, that's my name. I said, no, your name is Jesus. I guess you spell it H-A-Y-S-O-U-S, Jesus, right? Said, no, man. My name is Jesus. I said, yeah, Jesus. It's not Jesus. Said, my name is Jesus. Come to find out, after going back and forth with an Abbott and Costello routine for 10 minutes, that Jesus, J-E-S-U-S, is pronounced Jesus in this Latin world. And I was floored. I said, well, I don't understand how you, I said, and we became friends in the sense, and I learned a lot about the Latin life, and he learned a lot about the Jewish life. By the way, I was never, how can I put this tastefully without talking about religion? I was a horrible poster child for Judaism. I mean, I never went to one of those places, those synagogue temple things, and if I did, I was dragged there, and I probably masturbated in the bathroom, and I had no interest in religion whatsoever. I thought that a lot of my own people were petty and ridiculous. But it's a blood religion. You can't really get out of it. You can't say, I quit. Here's my blood. Take my blood back. I quit. You can't do that, kind of. So anyway, so we are talking and stuff like that. And I get, Jesus comes up to me and says, Ron, you got the phone call. I said, oh. So I go into the manager's office, and Robert Edwards, the manager, standing there, says, you got a phone call. And I say, hello. And it's Joan. It's my father's new wife, which I guess is my stepmother. I never liked the term stepmother because it sounds like either I'm stepping on her or she's from Cinderella and she's going to make me scrub the floor before I go to the ball. I mean, there's just stepmother to me is an evil connotation, so don't like it. I don't like step anything. No steps for me. Thank you so much. No steps for me. Joan says, "Do you know a girl named Cynthia?" And I said, "No, I don't." I said, "She's just called. She got our number from a friend of a friend, and she said she used to go to school with you, Cynthia. Cynthia. I said, "Yes, you do know her." I said, "Oh my God." OMG God, Jesus, my God. When I was in second grade, this girl sat next to me, and she was gorgeous. Her face was like a cherub angel. She was my first turn on. She was the first person that made my little Willie go silly. She made stuff move in me. She was, and I hadn't heard of her since. I hadn't seen her since. But my God, Cynthia contacted me, and I said to Joan, "Why?" She says, "I don't know, but I got a phone number. When you get home, I'll give it to you. I thought I'd call and tell you because I don't know who she is. I thought maybe she's some girl and you're having her baby or something." I said, "No, I'm not having anybody's baby." Cynthia called me. Oh my God. So I remember the subway ride home was like it couldn't be fast enough, and I get home and it's about 9 o'clock at night at this point, and I call Cynthia immediately, and on the other end of the phone I hear this voice,
"Hello,
hello, this is Ron Van Dam."
"Oh, Ron, I've been trying to reach you. I was going through it, and someone said that they knew where you were."
"So I didn't even know that you remembered me."
"So, yes. Second grade, I sat next to you. You were the first man that made my Willie move."
"So, all right. Perhaps an anatomy class might be a good idea here, but nonetheless, I'll take it. "So, oh, my God." I said, "Oh, and how you doing?" And we sat on the phone for like an hour. Well, we didn't sit on the phone. We talked on the phone. If we sat on the phone, we'd just hear each other's asses go off every once in a while. No, we talked on the phone. We didn't sit on the phone. And she said,
"What are you doing these days?"
"So I work in a movie theater."
"Oh, that's so romantic. I love to see you. I love to talk to you and spend some time."
"So, oh my God, I would love to see you too, Cynthia. Oh my God, this is wonderful. Why don't you come? Do you have a car?"
"Yes."
"Why don't you come to New York?" And yeah. And come to New York, and
And she said, well, I don't have a car because I'm not old enough to drive. I have a permit, but I can't come to New York. But I can take them. I can go to the theater and meet you there.
So, yes. Why don't you do that?
So, right. And then after...
I said, well, after we can go out to dinner and maybe do a little dancing.
She said, oh, yes. I can't wait to see you.
I can't wait to see you, Cynthia.
But I can't wait to see you.
But I can't wait to see you, Cynthia.
I can't wait to see you.
I can't wait to see you,
but I can't wait to see you.
All right, fine. So, Saturday couldn't come fast enough. This was on a Thursday, and then Friday came, and I was just every minute on the clock. And then Saturday came, and oh, it was like the biggest day of my life. Kids, you have no idea how beautiful this girl was. Man, she was just gorgeous. Oh, she was gorgeous. Gorgeous, gorgeous girl. Oh, man. She could have been a supermodel. In second grade, she could have been a supermodel. And then I'm wondering, what does she look like now, though? Maybe she, either she grew up to be, like, incredible, or maybe not, you know, or maybe her looks went away as she got older, but probably even got better, I guess. But I was, all the stuff's going through my mind, all these scenarios. The shift is over. It's like it's 8:30, and I'm standing in front of the theater, and I'm just waiting for her to pull up. Now I assume she's going to be pulling up in a cab or getting off a bus or something like that. And I'm looking, and every single car that goes by, I'm looking inside the car, going, "Is that her? Is 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 it her? Is it her? Oh, there's a pretty girl. There's a pretty girl. Oh, no. And I'm waiting, 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 and my heart is beating, and everything's beating on me. I'm just beating all over the place. And I'm standing there. And it's a beautiful night outside. It's like perfect 70 degrees in New York. The lights, it's romantic. Everything's going to be perfect. It's just, you couldn't write a story better than this. You couldn't write a scenario better than this. This was like the pinnacle of a motion picture itself. And then a cab pulls up in front of the theater. And on the passenger side in the back seat of the cab is this girl. And her head turns toward me as I stand at the curb in front of the theater. And she points to me and she smiles. It's her. It's Cynthia. God, and her face is beautiful. Probably the most beautiful female I'd ever seen in my life. And I see her leaning forward, getting into her purse and paying the cab driver. Every move, even the lean forward, was just beautiful. Every move she made, I felt like I was I had done something that warranted this incredible dream to come true for me. And then she turns toward me inside the cab, and the door begins to open. And I'm just wild in anticipation. But I've already seen her in the cab. I've already seen her through the window. She is everything that I thought she would grow up to be. And the door opens, and these beautiful, beautiful legs emerge from the taxi cab door. They drop from the door to the street. These beautiful legs in heels, in high heels. Thin, lovely. And the door opens further, and she gets up from the seat of the cab and stands up. And all of a sudden, my heart drops. She is the most beautiful girl in the world, but standing outside next to the cab, she's not even tall enough to have her head reach the height of the cab. She's like 4'3" or something like that. She's a fucking midget. And as beautiful as she is, since second grade, she didn't grow an inch. Nothing. She's tiny. You know how tall I am? Do you know how tall I am? I'm 6'3". And back in those days, I actually stood up straight. And I looked like I was 6'4", and I wore like what they call Beetle boots. I was good 6'4". She's a good 4'1", maybe. She could have starred in as an Oompa Loompa. An attractive one, but yet an Oompa Loompa. Yeah. So she walks toward me. I walk toward her. She gives me a good hug in the crotch. And I bent down to give her a kiss on the cheek and to pick up a piece of paper off the street. Same level. And we stood there on the curb, and she said, you look better than I ever could imagine. It's my turn. Oh, Cynthia, you're just as pretty as you were in second grade.
Oh, thank you. You know what I love to do, Ron?
What?
I love to go dancing.
Dancing? Are you serious?
I love to dance. And you told me on the phone that there were all these dance clubs right around the movie theater within walking distance. Can we go to one of them?
Sure. And she actually grabbed my hand. I mean, she's coming on to me. It doesn't happen a lot. Enough, but not a lot. We're walking hand in hand. And I'm watching the expression of people coming the other direction on the sidewalk. And they're probably wondering, what's that guy doing with his daughter? He doesn't look old enough to have children. Isn't that adorable? Oh, God. And we get to this dance club, and we get in there, and people are dancing, and I don't know.
I love to dance. Let's go dance.
And we get onto the dance floor, and there's mirrors all over the place in this nightclub. And you can see me bopping around, my body bopping around, and in the mirror, it looks like I'm dancing by myself because her body is like totally obliterated by everybody else. You can't even see her. And it was just, it was difficult for me. It was very difficult. A gorgeous woman, but miniature size. You know what I mean? It was like, I'm the big candy bar and she's one of those Halloween short little packages. Get your hand out to the kids. You wouldn't give them an entire Milky Way bar at Halloween. You give them a miniature. Nobody gets a full bar. Well, I wasn't getting a full bar that night either. And we're dancing and we're having a good time and everything's wonderful. And we're dancing and we're dancing to this music for some reason. And we're having some drinks and I figure maybe after a few drinks she'll look taller. But she didn't. I just looked larger or something. But I gotta tell you, we did have a great time. We did dance, and I don't even really dance. I hate to dance, really. I just said I liked to dance because she said she liked to dance, and now it wasn't worth lying about anymore. But, you know, we're laughing about the old days in second grade and the other people in the class and our views on life, talking about Jesus, how it's spelled completely different from what it sounds like, and she finds that to be fascinatingly funny. And it comes the end of the night. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. And she looks up at me. And she had no choice but to look up at me. I mean, she is a great girl. Suffice to say, I was nuts over her. Physically. But I think she kind of knew that I was uncomfortable. And at the end, I bent down to give her a little kiss and a hug and tie her shoes. It's not true, she was wearing heels. And she whispers in my ear,
"It was great seeing you again, Ron. I guess you've noticed our height difference is a little bit different."
And of course, I had no recourse but to say, "What? Are you kidding me? I didn't even notice."
"It was so good seeing you again. Let's talk on the phone."
"Okay. Bye, Cynthia."
"Bye, Ron."
"Bye." And she got into a taxi cab, and away the cab drove in the dark and the glitter of the New York night. And I stood there and I felt bad about myself, because she's wonderful, but I, for physical reasons, just wasn't working. I guess it was my first real encounter with the realities of life. Do I think about Cynthia? No. But I remember that story, and I remember that night, and I remember the great anticipation and the letdown only because of my silly insecurities about height differences.
And that was another funny story from Ron. Wait, that was supposed to be funny? Wow.
You're listening to Ron Van Dam on Metro South Podcasting. Oi, he's such a mensch. I mean, a nice mensch, don't get me wrong, but still, really, a mensch.
To many, that's a sad story. A story of bigotry. A story of height profiling. But for me, it's more a story of love. An impossible love. I think we all experience impossible love. It is a love that exists, and like energy, cannot be destroyed, but at the same time, a love that can't really be exercised, or improved, or even possible. It's one of the greatest dilemmas of life. Love, but I can't love that. But I do love that, but I can't love that. And it's all based on our securities and insecurities and purities and our sureties and our florities and our pleities and all the other things that come into the mix. It makes the human being a far more complicated entity than we could ever imagine. Did that night make me a different person? No. but it did teach me a lesson. It taught me that I have no idea. Wonderful day, and I'll be with you tomorrow. Until then, I wish you peace.